In a nation where firearms outnumber people, few issues divide Americans as deeply as guns. Philip J. Cook's The Gun Debate offers a masterful navigation through this contentious landscape, examining the complex relationship between Americans and their estimated 300 million firearms. The book has become required reading in policy circles, with former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens calling it the most comprehensive analysis of gun policy in America ever written. Barack Obama cited it during his push for gun reforms following the Sandy Hook tragedy, while even gun rights advocates respect its balanced approach. Since its publication, the book has shaped discourse on campuses nationwide, with professors across the political spectrum assigning it for its empirical rigor and fair-minded analysis. As mass shootings continue to dominate headlines and Americans remain deadlocked on solutions, Cook's evidence-based examination of both the benefits and costs of firearms in American society provides essential context for one of our most intractable debates. America's relationship with guns is exceptional among developed nations, standing apart in both scale and cultural significance. With approximately 300 million firearms in civilian hands, nearly one per person, the United States maintains the highest private gun ownership rate among wealthy countries, far exceeding rates in comparable nations like Canada, 34.7 per 100 people, and France, 19.6 per 100 people. Yet this massive arsenal is concentrated among a minority of Americans, creating a distinctive pattern of ownership. Recent surveys indicate only about 22-30% of American adults personally own firearms, translating to roughly 63 million gun owners. More striking is the distribution pattern. Most gun owners possess multiple firearms, with nearly as many owning five or more guns as those owning just one. This concentration has intensified over time, with super owners possessing 10 or more firearms accounting for about 3% of adults but owning roughly 20% of the total gun stock. The demographic profile of gun owners reveals clear and persistent patterns that reflect broader social and cultural divisions. Men are 3 times more likely than women to own firearms, with male ownership rates around 39% compared to 12% for women. Whites own guns at significantly higher rates than African Americans or Latinos, with ownership rates of 36% among whites versus 24% and 15% respectively for other groups. Rural residents are twice as likely as city dwellers to possess firearms, reflecting both cultural traditions and practical considerations like hunting and agricultural needs. People who grew up with guns in their homes are 3 times more likely to own guns as adults, demonstrating the strong intergenerational transmission of gun culture. Education correlates with ownership in a curvilinear pattern. Those with some college are more likely to own guns than either college graduates or those with only high school education. Political affiliation shows one of the starkest divides, with Republicans twice as likely as Democrats to own firearms, a gap that has widened significantly since the 1990s. What's particularly fascinating is how gun ownership motivations have evolved over time, reflecting changing social conditions and perceptions. Protection against crime has become the dominant reason, cited by 48% of owners in 2013, nearly double the percentage from 1999. This surpasses traditional motivations like hunting, 32%, and sports shooting, 7%, as the primary justification, despite this shift occurring during a period of declining crime rates nationwide. This paradox suggests that perceived threat rather than actual crime rates drives many ownership decisions. This contradiction, declining household ownership along increasing total guns, reflects a fundamental transformation in America's gun culture. Domestic shipments of new firearms surged from 4.6 million in 2003 to a record 16.3 million in 2016, with particular spikes following high-profile mass shootings and political events. The market has also shifted dramatically toward handguns, which increased from 21% of new guns in the 1950s to over 50% since 2008. This preference for handguns, particularly for self-defense, comes with significant public health implications, as handguns account for about 75% of firearms murders and suicides. The trend toward concealed carry permits and constitutional carry laws has further accelerated this shift toward handguns, with millions of Americans now legally authorized to carry concealed weapons in public spaces. What's particularly fascinating is how gun ownership motivations have evolved over time, reflecting changing social conditions and perceptions. Protection against crime has become the dominant reason, cited by 48% of owners in 2013, nearly double the percentage from 1999. This surpasses traditional motivations like hunting, 32%, and sports shooting, 7%, as the primary justification, despite this shift occurring during a period of declining crime rates nationwide. This paradox suggests that perceived threat, rather than actual crime rates, drives many ownership decisions. This contradiction, declining household ownership along increasing total guns, reflects a fundamental transformation in America's gun culture. Domestic shipments of new firearms surged from 4.6 million in 2003 to a record 16.3 million in 2016, with particular spikes following high-profile mass shootings and political events. The market has also shifted dramatically toward handguns, which increased from 21% of new guns in the 1950s to over 50% since 2008. This preference for handguns, particularly for self-defense, comes with significant public health implications, as handguns account for about 75% of firearms murders and suicides. The trend toward concealed carry permits and constitutional carry laws has further accelerated this shift toward handguns, with millions of Americans now legally authorized to carry concealed weapons in public spaces. Self-defense has become the cornerstone of gun rights advocacy in America. The nightmare scenario of being defenseless against violent attackers drives many to seek firearms for peace of mind. This motivation gained constitutional legitimacy through the Supreme Court's landmark 2008 Heller decision, which established an individual right to keep arms for self-defense, particularly in the home. But how effective are guns for self-protection? The answer is nuanced. While someone able to effectively deploy a firearm when attacked may fare better than if unarmed, introducing a gun can also escalate violence or lead to tragic misunderstandings. Data from the National Crime Victimization Survey shows victims used guns in self-defense in less than 1% of personal contact crimes like assaults and robberies. Comparing injury rates following different self-protective actions reveals little difference in outcomes. Victims who used guns had a 2.4% chance of subsequent injury versus 1.7% for other weapons and 2.8% for any self-protection action. The frequency of defensive gun use, DGU, has generated intense debate with wildly divergent answers. The National Crime Victimization Survey suggests about 50,000 defensive gun uses annually in violent crimes and 20,000 in property crimes, roughly 1% of all violent crimes. In contrast, telephone surveys like Gary Kleck and Mark Gertz's widely cited study claim 2.5 million DGUs annually, 25 times higher than NCVS estimates. This discrepancy stems from methodological differences. NCVS only asks about defensive actions to those reporting victimization, while phone surveys ask everyone, creating opportunities for false positives from misremembered events or exaggerated claims. For home defense specifically, the benefits must be weighed against clear risks, including accidental shootings, suicide, and escalated domestic violence. A Harvard study comparing states with high versus low gun ownership found four times as many gun suicides in high ownership states despite identical non-gun suicide rates. Actual defensive gun use occurs in only about 3% of home invasions, roughly 31,000 times annually, meaning just one in 3,500 gun-owning households uses a firearm defensively against an intruder in a given year. What about concealed carry? Despite successful pro-gun efforts to deregulate concealed carry, more than two-thirds of states still required special permits as of 2019. Approximately 17 million Americans hold such permits, about one-quarter of all gun owners. The claim that widespread gun carry deters crime remains contentious. Economist John Lott's influential research suggested states adopting shall-issue concealed carry laws experienced reduced homicide rates. However, subsequent scientific scrutiny has undermined these findings. The National Academy of Sciences convened an expert panel that, with just one dissent, judged Lott's findings unreliable. The scale of America's gun violence is staggering. Approximately 1 million Americans have died from gunshot wounds in just the last three decades, exceeding all U.S. combat deaths in history. In 2017 alone, firearms killed 39,773 people, 15,095 homicides, 23,854 suicides, and 486 accidents, matching traffic fatalities that year. Gunshot injuries account for 1 in 13 years of potential life lost before age 65. Beyond fatalities, emergency rooms treated 85,000 non-fatal gunshot injuries in 2015, including 63,000 from criminal assaults. Police recorded over 300,000 gun-involved assaults and robberies that year. Firearms are the predominant lethal weapon, used in three-quarters of homicides and half of suicides. Young men face dramatically disproportionate risk of gun violence victimization. Males aged 18 to 34 account for half of all murder victims, with stark racial disparities. In 2017, homicide victimization rates were 16 times higher for African Americans than for non-Hispanic whites. Homicide ranks as the leading cause of death for young African American males and the second leading cause for Latino males in this age group. Among all men in this age range, 89% of homicides involve firearms. Why are guns of more concern than other weapons? While gun rights advocates claim guns don't kill people, people kill people, this overlooks how firearms dramatically enhance lethal capacity. Robberies and assaults committed with guns are far more likely to result in death than those with other weapons. Gun robberies have a case fatality rate 3 times higher than knife robberies and 10 times higher than robberies with other weapons. For serious injuries from assaults, gunshot wounds are 12 times more likely to be fatal than knife wounds. Franklin Zimring's influential research demonstrated that fatal and non-fatal attacks often differ only by chance, whether a bullet or blade finds a vital organ, not by the attacker's intent. His study showed that larger caliber firearms are more likely to cause death than smaller ones, confirming that weapon lethality, not just assailant intent, determines outcomes. Firearms also dramatically increase suicide risk due to their exceptional lethality. While guns are used in relatively few suicide attempts, they account for half of all completed suicides with an 85% fatality rate, far higher than other common methods. Most suicide attempts are impulsive responses to temporary crises rather than carefully planned acts. Research shows 24% of near-lethal suicide attempts occurred within just 5 minutes of the decision, and 70% within 1 hour. Almost all crime guns begin with a licensed dealer sale before following one of three primary pathways: direct purchase by the eventual criminal, straw purchases where someone legally buys a gun for a prohibited person, or, most commonly, guns that circulate for years through gifts, loans, thefts, and private sales before criminal use. This last pathway, known as the gray market, can involve multiple transfers over several years, making tracking extremely difficult. Studies show the average crime gun changes hands 3 to 4 times before being used in an offense. ATF trace data reveals guns frequently cross state lines, flowing from states with lax regulations to those with stricter controls. The infamous Iron Pipeline refers to the Interstate 95 corridor, where guns purchased in states like Georgia, South Carolina, and Virginia regularly end up in northeastern cities like New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. Similarly, approximately 60% of crime guns recovered in Chicago originate from out of state, with neighboring Indiana serving as the primary source. These trafficking operations typically involve small-scale operators rather than large criminal enterprises, often individuals making occasional trips with 5-10 guns at a time, using personal vehicles and established interstate routes. When Missouri repealed its handgun permit requirement in 2007, the percentage of crime guns moving directly from dealer to criminal tripled from 3.3% to 9.9%, demonstrating how regulations affect the illicit supply chain. This change also corresponded with a 25% increase in firearm-related homicides. Similarly, when the Brady Act's background check requirement was implemented in 1994, the percentage of Chicago crime guns originating from states newly required to conduct background checks dropped dramatically overnight from 35% to 14%, illustrating the immediate impact of federal regulations. Theft represents a significant source of crime guns, with approximately 300,000 firearms stolen annually, 251,000 from residential burglaries, and thousands more from gun shops and government facilities. In 2020 alone, over 7,800 firearms were stolen from licensed dealers. Handguns constitute 63% of stolen firearms, despite being less common than long guns in American households, possibly due to their higher black market value, typically $200 to $500, or less secure storage. Many stolen guns are quickly trafficked across state lines to avoid detection. According to prison inmate surveys and ATF investigations, most criminals obtain guns through informal channels rather than direct retail purchases. Among male inmates aged 18 to 40, 39% got guns from friends or family, often knowing the weapons were stolen, 33% from street sources or black markets, and only 11% from licensed dealers. Just 1% acquired guns from gun shows, contradicting common assumptions about this source. Only 56% purchased their guns with cash, 30% received them as gifts or borrowed them, while merely 5% admitted stealing them directly. The low reported theft rate likely reflects reluctance to admit crimes rather than actual acquisition patterns. Gun regulations in America reflect the country's federalist system, creating a patchwork of laws across federal, state, and local jurisdictions. Federal laws provide a basic floor of public safety measures, primarily licensing dealers, regulating interstate sales, and restricting certain categories of people from owning weapons. States, and sometimes cities, complement these with their own measures, often strengthening restrictions on transfer and possession. The Second Amendment, ratified in 1791, states, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Its interpretation has been contested between those who see it protecting state militias, militia theory, and those who view it as guaranteeing individual gun ownership, individual rights theory. The Supreme Court rarely addressed this question until 2008, when, in District of Columbia v. Heller, a 5-4 majority under Justice Scalia ruled that the amendment protects an individual's right to possess firearms for self-defense, invalidating D.C.'s handgun ban. Federal gun regulation has emerged in three distinct waves, each triggered by firearms violence. The first wave came during Prohibition, with the 1927 ban on mailing handguns, the 1934 National Firearms Act requiring registration of machine guns and sawed-off shotguns, and the 1938 Federal Firearms Act creating dealer licensing. The second wave followed the 1968 assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, producing the Gun Control Act that restricted interstate gun shipments and expanded prohibited purchaser categories. The third wave came in the early 1990s, with the Brady Act requiring background checks for dealer sales and the 1994 assault weapons ban, which expired in 2004. Federal law prohibits gun ownership by several categories of people: felons and those under indictment, fugitives, unlawful drug users, those adjudicated as mentally ill or committed to mental institutions, undocumented immigrants, those dishonorably discharged from the military, former citizens who've renounced citizenship, and domestic abusers subject to restraining orders or convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence. Gun law stringency follows clear geographic patterns. The strictest regulations cluster in coastal states: California, Hawaii, and Washington on the West Coast, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island on the East Coast, plus Illinois in the Midwest. The least restrictive states are concentrated in the South and Southwest: Arizona, Kentucky, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and the rural West: Alaska, Idaho, the Dakotas, Kansas, Montana, Utah, and Wyoming. The relationship between public opinion and gun policy represents a paradox in American politics. Most citizens favor various firearms regulations, yet these popular measures rarely become law. This disconnect has persisted for decades, with one scholar noting it's difficult to imagine any other issue on which Congress has been less responsive to public sentiment for a longer period of time. Public opinion on gun control presents a complex picture. Support for stricter gun laws declined from the early 1990s through 2010 before stabilizing and rising again, with about 60% of Americans now favoring stricter laws, according to Gallup. When asked about specific policies rather than general orientation, Americans show strong support for measures like universal background checks, 85 to 90%, creating a federal database to track gun sales, and banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. However, proposals targeting mainstream firearms that good guys might want receive much less support. Fewer than 30% of Americans back a ban on civilian handgun possession. The most striking development in gun policy attitudes is the growing partisan divide, which has reached a remarkable 60 percentage point gap between Democrats and Republicans, far greater than differences by race, gender, geography, or even gun ownership. In fact, asking whether someone owns a gun has become one of the best predictors of party affiliation. The gun control paradox, that most Americans want stronger gun laws but rarely get them, stems more from organizational differences than intensity gaps. While surveys show similar levels of passion on both sides, 42% of gun control supporters feel strongly about the issue versus 37% of gun rights supporters, the gun rights movement has historically been more effective at translating passion into action. Gun rights supporters have been 3 to 4 times more likely to donate money to organizations and significantly more likely to contact officials, sign petitions, or express opinions online. The gun rights movement's extraordinary influence stems from several factors. First, its committed membership base of approximately 4 million gun owners provides grassroots power in America's fragmented political system. The NRA excels at generating true engagement. Members who attend town halls, contact officials, write letters, and vote based on gun rights positions. Second, the lobby structure mirrors government itself, with national, state, and local organizations applying pressure across all levels and branches of government. Third, gun groups offer multiple incentives for membership. Tangible benefits like magazines and discounts, social incentives including awards and community connections, and the powerful sense of meaning that comes from defending American values. Despite America's vast firearm supply, evidence suggests certain regulations effectively reduce gun crime. While there are enough guns for every adult, only 1 in 4 adults actually owns firearms, and most violent crimes are committed without guns. Most criminals who use guns obtain them through informal transactions from friends, family, or street sources, transactions that are easier in states with higher gun ownership rates. The federal assault weapons ban, 1994 to 2004, showed no compelling evidence of saving lives, though a more stringent or longer-lasting ban might have been more effective. In contrast, the 1934 National Firearms Act effectively suppressed machine gun use in crime through registration requirements and a prohibitive $200 transfer tax. By 2017, machine guns represented only 4 in 1,000 crime guns traced by law enforcement. Temporary gun buyback programs in the U.S. typically have little impact on gun violence. People tend to surrender broken or redundant firearms rather than those that might be used in crime, and cash payments can perversely fund replacement gun purchases. Australia's 1997 mandatory buyback of newly illegal semi-automatic rifles was remarkably successful, removing approximately one-third of the country's firearms, over 1 million guns. Strong evidence indicates this reduced gun homicide and ended the previously regular occurrence of mass shootings, though such a program would be politically unfeasible in the United States. Research shows homes with firearms are 5 times more likely to see domestic violence escalate to homicide. In response, Congress banned gun possession for those under restraining orders for domestic violence, 1994, and those with domestic violence misdemeanor convictions, 1996 Lautenberg Amendment. Evaluations show these laws save lives. State laws banning guns for those under restraining orders reduced intimate partner homicide by approximately 8%, while the Lautenberg Amendment reduced female intimate partner gun murders by 17% with no compensating increase in non-gun murders. Several police tactics have proven effective in reducing gun violence. Boston's Operation Ceasefire pioneered focused deterrence strategies by targeting gangs with the message that gun use by any member would result in crackdowns on all members. This retail deterrence approach led to a sharp reduction in youth homicides and has been successfully replicated elsewhere. Hotspots policing concentrates resources in high-crime areas with minimal displacement effects. After the 2007 Virginia Tech shooting, Congress funded state-level efforts to improve reporting of mental health disqualifications to background check systems. An alternative approach focuses on dangerousness through extreme risk protection orders, or red flag laws, which allow temporary removal of firearms from people threatening themselves or others. Connecticut's implementation has prevented approximately 1 suicide for every 10 orders issued, with 17 states having adopted some version by 2019. Every aspect of guns, gun violence, and gun policy remains contentious in America. Despite hopes that the Supreme Court's 2008 Heller decision might enable consensus-based regulations, no significant national gun legislation has passed since then. The widespread deregulation of guns has been supported by an ethos of self-reliance and the contested claim that an armed society is a polite society. For decades, gun violence prevention advocates have urged development of personalized guns that fire only for the rightful owner. Using technologies like radio frequency identification or biometrics, these smart guns would prevent household diversion to children, unauthorized youth access, suicidal family members, and theft. While some worry that smart guns might increase gun ownership through risk compensation, these concerns likely wouldn't negate safety gains. Most gun assaults occur outside the home, involving weapons carried by perpetrators. Alternative tactics to traditional policing show promise, including focused deterrence strategies like Boston's Operation Ceasefire, which targeted gangs with clear consequences for gun violence. Courts must treat illicit gun carrying as serious rather than victimless. Most critically, clearance rates for shootings need improvement. Cities like Chicago arrest fewer than 20% of shooting offenders, with similar dismal records in Baltimore, New Orleans, and St. Louis. Despite limited federal funding, productive gun violence research programs are underway in social sciences, law, and public health at universities and think tanks. States and private foundations have stepped in to fill funding gaps, with the Joyce Foundation making sustained contributions and Arnold Ventures announcing a $50 million program over 5 years in 2018. Since the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre, research has surged, beginning to provide a sound evidence base for policymaking. Government policies influence behavior most effectively when backed by social support. Regulations can make unhealthy behaviors more problematic, but social influence reinforces norms encouraging prudent choices. Just as drunk driving deaths declined through both legal penalties and changing social attitudes, and smoking decreased through taxes and ordinances reinforced by community disapproval, gun safety could benefit from similar social norm development. Traditional norms have led hunters and sportsmen to respect firearms' potential harm and embrace safe practices in storing, handling, and using guns. A balanced view acknowledges both the pleasures of gun sports and collecting and the peace of mind from self-defense, while recognizing guns can cause great harm even in the hands of generally law-abiding adults who might drink too much, be easily provoked, act carelessly, or lack proper training. Finding the right balance between risks and benefits in both policy and social teaching has proven difficult for firearms, but there remains hope for reasoned discussion based on the best available information.